So I'd like to welcome everyone to the third in our series of seminars on early modern religious thought. And we had Richard Williams last week talking about the Radha Vallabhis, and now we have, very happy to have, Sanjukta Gupta speaking about Madhusudana Saraswati. Thank you very much.
Thank you, all of them, for coming. Because Madhusudana Saraswati is not a popular man amongst the Indologists. Mm-hmm. In recent times, I think for last 40 years, there are 3 papers on him, and that's about all. Because he used very tough Sanskrit, and it is tough, stiff, because it is naturally his subject was so. That it is not the ordinary Sanskrit, not the Kavya Sanskrit, but the Sanskrit of the philosophers. So they have to be very much strict in their terminology, in their way of putting, and of course they couldn't put a one subject or even as a one decision without going through the logical terms. So if I want to say today, I will talk about Madhusudana Saraswati, I'll have to tell that I will talk about a person who is Manushattavina Mani Manusha, who is a man qualified by manness, the commonality, only then I can call him a man, not just a man, but the man who is qualified by manness. So this was the language which discouraged everybody from reading. But this is the language of his time. Now, the focus of this seminar, as you know, innovation in the modern, so-called early modern times. I thought it was late medieval, never mind, misnomer, but something. It's the modern idea of early modern. I don't quarrel with Polly or anybody. So, be it early modern, he's from 16th century. So it can be early modern, if we think so. If we think the early Mughal Empire was early modern, so this is early modern. He was contemporary of the earlier Mughal kings like Akbar and so. And his time is quite a different period than as previous people. First of all, the outlook was different. Some call it the paradigm change, that the sort of way to present things that was modeled before was slightly changed. Because the way Shankaracharya or Padmapadacharya or Prakashatma Muni, they presented things was not quite acceptable because that was too difficult. That was one of the important features of him, that he was in the line of the great dialectical authors in Advaita Vedanta like Harsha, Sri Harsha, and Chitsukhacharya. They used this sort of extremely polemical language. Every sentence was tight-fitting and you cannot sort of disintegrate it by saying, yeah, this is not correct, that's not correct. That was the every sentence will be full, quite. And that was this Shankarite dialecticians, and Madhusudana belonged to them. And that was a way of paradigm change again, because it was not as the earlier Shankara's disciples did, until Bhamatikara Vachaspati Mishra. But they were just putting their thing and each way sort of showing that they are talking about things which had been already discussed in Upanishads. And that was their proof that they are talking reality. But they were going to discuss about totally different thing than what Madhusudana had to discuss. Madhusudana came in a period when all this monotheistic religious systems came into being. And they were all calling themselves Vedantins. Vishishtadvaita Vedantins, Dvaitadvaita Vedantins, Shuddhadvaita Vedantins. You go on, they are all Vedantins. So they are not telling people that we don't believe in Vedic examples. They do believe in Vedic examples. They do believe in a monotheism, which is monistic, but as well as it is theism. They believed in a god, personal god, but they incorporated Brahman, impersonal reality, the essence of everything that one experiences in the empirical time, but who is not at all involved or related even to the empirical objects, phenomena. Such a person is Brahman, who is the essence, which is just one way a bit deviant from the Buddhists. And hence, Shankara was called the Prachanna Buddhist, the secret Buddhist, because he wasn't, because he had to push in Brahman. And so his idea was to make this essentialism correctly established. Brahman is the essence of everything. And that Brahman is ineffable, transcendent, indeterminate reality. And that reality is the only reality, because it never changes. That which changes is not real. This idea becomes very important. Everything in the empirical creation changes. It's born, it develops, it stays for a time, then it decays and it's gone. These stages of changes do not exist in the real existence, and that is Brahman. Brahman never changes. It's changeless. So when one have to incorporate such a thing, that Brahman is not in any way related to it, there is no relationship there. It's completely ineffable. It's absolutely away. Then who does create the universe? How does the universe get into existence? Brahman is doing nothing. If he cannot do anything, nothing, then how to explain the whole thing? Earlier on, philosophers turned into agamas, and there is one set of agamas called Pancharatra. They invented or incorporated, Pancharatra is an ancient system, which went away from the Shastra of Vedas, Agama. It is called, but it is pseudo-Agama. It's not really Vedic. And that's why it is, at the beginning, it was a bit outside Agama or the orthodox systems of philosophy, because they depended on Agama, on the real Agama, the Vedas. But later, Pancharatra and the Shaiva Agamas, they both became very important, almost as canonical as the Vedas. And philosophers depended on them, because what they are about to say, all the monotheists, and what they're about to say is that, yes, the supreme reality is Brahman, but a bit plus Brahman. Brahman plus is that it has a power. And this power it has, it is an appearance. It has a power which is called Maya. Maya is a power. We have the idea in the Vedas, where in one of the hymns it is said that Indra, Mayavi, Puru Rupam Iyate. Indra, through his Maya, can take multiple forms. So Indra, God, could have a special power which is called Maya. That Maya is taken into the Pancharatra thing, and God's power was created. Because without that, God's power, which is inherent, which is not really different, but also it is somewhat different. And that power is the relationship, the link between the transcendent God and the empirical creation, because it is through his power that he creates. He doesn't create, he doesn't change, power changed. But the power is nothing new. Power is his Maya oblique Prakriti. Now, Prakriti is a wonderful word, as Maya is a word for which may mean magic, or may mean really inscrutable power, in the Indra's case. Also, Prakriti may mean the source, but also it may mean the nature. It's my nature that I am irascible. I am irascible Prakriti. I can be very irascible. So I can, the same word can be used in two ways. And that is what, in this area of the later period, when Bhagavata Purana became so important for all these monotheistic people, especially the Vaishnavas, that it produced that idea sort of again. Pancharatra was a background, but Bhagavata Purana became very widely popular. Bhagavata Purana's idea is absolutely that Pancharatra idea, that God is completely transcendental, but God has a personality, so to say. And whatever we think about God as his personality is actually his Shakti. So if God is God is all powerful, it's the Shakti is all powerful. God doesn't. It is as if that is the bridge. Nothing can be predicated of God, but Shakti comes as a bridge, and everything she can do. She can create. I am saying she, because Shakti is grammatically a feminine word. And hence, it has a very far-reaching effect in the theology, that Shakti, God's Shakti, which is a notion, an idea, but later it was hypostatized as a goddess, socialized as God's wife, and so forth. But it is really the theologically, whatever action, even at the beginning of creation, primordial time, God has to produce space. There was nothing. And God, if God created, we create things with some material. God had nothing. There was nothing. So his power supplied everything. Also, God has to think to create. You cannot create without a little bit of thinking. That thought is also Shakti. So it is God's personality who is Shakti. Shakti is God's personality. In one of the Pancharatra texts, it is called, if God is Aham, when the God is saying Aham, it is his Ahamta. I-ness, that is Shakti. They have to coin a new word. So much for the Pancharatra. So, Pancharatra is very important because of Bhagavata Purana, which became so important at that period that we are talking about. Most of the Vaishnavas borrowed something from the Bhagavata Purana. Bhagavata Purana's idea of devotion was quite an interesting idea. But before going into that, I would like to say that if we say there came some changes or innovation at this period, we may ask why. The question comes, why did it come? We had a very excellent paper last week, really good. And that one, what he produced is very interesting, although a century later than what I am talking about, but very interesting to show the political, economical, and social sort of area of that part of North India and of that period. It is really very, very interesting. It was quite different from the period that was before. But at that time, the people of India were closely mixing with different theologies, culture, and languages due to the political history of the period. The Delhi royal center was in the hands of Islamic rulers, who brought with them not only a new and extremely vigorous theology, but also wholesale new ideas about political, social, and military systems from Middle East, Iran, Turkestan, and even Mongolia. They all came from that way. And they are not the same. They are very varied. But they were, when they arrived in India, they were all taken Islam. Army was very important area in here. Also last week we heard about it. Army was very important. Army belonging to the both Islamic and Hindu royalties became a great meeting point of different cultures. A new language sprang up in the military camps called Urdu, which means camp, military camp. And consequently, mercenaries coming from all sorts of religious and social background could easily exchange their cultural views. By the time Mughals established their power in Delhi, the Indian society became vastly changed. Quite a change came. Quite early in Delhi Sultanate period, many Hindus, soldiers, craftsmen, traders started converting into Islam. As Iqtidar Hussain Siddiqui records, with the foundation of Sultanate in North India, considerable changes took place in the socio-political life of the country. The multi-state self-system that had evolved after Emperor Harsha, the last Hindu emperor, gave way to a centralized political organization. The old cities took on the form of cosmopolitan urban centers, while the newly founded towns and cities, artisans and craftsmen, considered low caste in the Hindu social system, could now live in their huts, even in the vicinity of the quarters owned by the ruling elite. This process of urbanization started under sultans, which soon led to social mobility. Among craftsmen in the urban centers, the same author also records that in the relevant period, a large number of people from Central Asia migrated to Delhi and its surrounding area seeking jobs and other sources of economic opportunities. Many of them were poor. The immigrants, who were not all from privileged families, got opportunities of education in madrasas, and thus bettered themselves, a new middle class growing at that period. The converted Hindus, sitting side by side with these immigrants, got introduced to a wide, volatile, and novel social contact, enabling them to develop a freer personal outlook and worldview. The author concludes, the progress of learning, expansion, and consolidation of the central authority, cultural influence, such as those of the Sufis, paved the way for the rise of people from unprivileged families in the society. Converted Muslims, too, fell in that social category. They became highly educated in Muslim political and economical legal systems, and even at the teeth of fierce competition from the privileged Muslim immigrants, were often recruited for high civil service. I may hazard here my guess that they most probably came in contact with the Sufis and may have conveyed their reactions to other unconverted friends and relatives. And so, by the time of the 14th, 15th century, the idea of a lovable God who is not my master, as in the Pancharatra or later Pancharatra Prapatti system, was that I give myself as cattle to my owner, and he can do all the things, and at the same time must protect me because I am his wealth. So as the wealthy farmer protects its cows and sheep and everything, he will protect me. This is not here. What in this time the situation was, is a close sort of Sufistic friendship with God, which is sweet, which is very much on an equal step. God loves me and I love God. It's not that I love God and God, as the owner, just protects me. This was the difference which the Sufis introduced. Don't forget this time also the Sant movement came up the same way. There have been Muslims in there, Hindus in there, and even soldiers from Rajput clans was there. So this was a mixture at that time, a total mixture of theology. The Muslim theology was very, very attractive. But it was not the Sunni or Shia Muslimite things, really. It was mainly an amalgamate of that. And that's the period when Sufism flourished in India. I eat and talk a lot about it, and Anna Marie also did. So you can find that how India sort of moved into a period, and not in a capsule, not in separate section, because they knew each other. And of course, if I know you, I will tell you something about me. If you know me, you will tell me something about it. And together, after a time, we change or somewhat make a new thing in my mind that, oh, what I thought was not, perhaps not quite right. Hence comes the Bhagavata Purana, and in the Bhagavata Purana, which is in one way very old-fashioned text, which was trying to put both the orthodox, agamic, or rather Vedic idea in it, and following the Upanishads, but also the tantric idea from the Pancharatra also in it. But it was a sort of elegant bhakti they were talking about, bhakti yoga, in which the old-fashioned renouncers who completely renounce everything, who only becomes introspect and don't try to get their mind stretch, go out, but sort of take them in, not, and that sort of thing are also there. And there are three stages in Bhagavata Purana where the old Ashtanga Yoga is mentioned. And that way, that is. But it also has the Gopi Gita. In the later part of Bhagavata Purana, 21st, and you see the gopis singing their longing for God.
The Gopi Gita is the Uddhava dialogue.
It was, no, just before that, the Gopi in the Rasa, when in the night they were dancing, they were feeling very nostalgic and sort of lovesick. And so they, in the night, because it was a full moon night, and Krishna is also not indifferent, so he also started playing on his flute, which is come hither thing. And so the gopis couldn't stay home. They rushed out, and there was a whole description of it. Where is Krishna? Oh, there is a footprint, there is this and there is that. This is a whole story. If you read it, it's very attractive. And it has all the sources of the Kavya development of aesthetic enjoyment. So this sort of approach was a new approach. And that approach was very important to remember, that Bhagavata has these two sides. And it was the two first commentators on Bhagavata Purana, Bopadeva and Sridhara Swami, they gave this impetus for the Neo-Vedantins who started thinking about it. Bopadeva, of the two, Bopadeva was less Advaita than Srinatha, Sridhara. Sridhara was a bit more Advaita and more conservative. And Bopadeva didn't write a full commentary. He wrote one as a sort of commentary of general commentary called Muktavali. And the other one was Bopadeva's other commentary is just a list of what is in Bhagavata Purana called Hari Lila. And not Muktavali, Muktafala. Muktafala was commented by Hemadri very elaborately. And this was all in the early 13th century, mid-13th century. And Bopadeva and Himadri was actually minister of the Yadava god, royalties in Malava. So he was quite powerful. And he was also very much in favor of it. And this went on for a long time, that Bopadeva was very important because of the royal backing. And the other one, the Hari Lila, which is a selection of all the things, a list of things that are in Bhagavata Puranam, was commented on by Madhusudana Saraswati. And in the commentary, we come across what really Madhusudana thought about Bopadeva. Now, Bopadeva started saying that there is in Bhagavata Purana, a system of gods which is decided in five ways. And in the handout, you will find that. Five ways. God in five ways, how he come down to us or appears to us. There are two sides of it. One is God, which is nirakara, formless. God, no form. Which is difficult for the theologist of Vedanta persuasion, because they are worshipping murtis. And God, formless God doesn't help anybody. There is then also the other area, which is formed, sakara. So Vishnu is an unique, now this nirakara form is called Vishnu, but he is this is an unique existence. And was at the time before creation there, and will be also existing there after the pralaya, as we believe it, after the reabsorption of the creation. Then he will be there. So this is Brahman almost, but the name is stuck Vishnu. And what happens that in between, at the primordial period, moment of creation, there comes this God's personality, God's inherent Maya or Prakriti. This is the underscoring of God. What is God? Who has Maya? Or whose nature, who is naturally going to create. His creation is natural, and this natural side, if you can think of it, has the Sankhya Prakriti of the three gunas. The Sankhya is pushed into this theistic idea. Sankhya is not very much theistic. It's a dualist. But here it is not dualist. It's pushed into God and his nature, Prakriti. When it is coming together, God is then distinguished now with the Prakriti, with that nature, and that nature has, God hasn't, the nature has Sattva, Rajas, Tamas, three gunas. At that point, the personalized God appears, Purusha, the God who is, as we can think of God, a person. Bhopadeva calls God Adideva, the original God, or Narayana, or Trivikrama. Interesting to think about it. Because God at that point produces also a body, Virat, Viraj it is called, that all comprising God's existence. And 2 points in mythology it is given. One is when Bali was all-powerful, Bali, demon, was all-powerful and was completely ousting the gods. Then Vishnu came to him and begged him as a Brahmin and said that I want also in your sacrificial performance my arms. And what the arms he wanted? I want place for my 3 steps. And the 3 steps he completely covered the creation. This is the Virat body, God's body, which incorporates all creation in it. And the second one is, of course, the Visharupa in Bhagavad Gita. In Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, in order to convince Arjuna that it is not he who is doing it, Krishna shows his Visharupa, that he is the creation. Everything is there. Even the fighting Kauravas and when they will go dead, all is in him. So this is called Viraj, Virat, Sharira. And that happens when all the 3 gunas are in him. When this happened, then comes the cosmic period and incorporates the Hindu 3 cosmic gods. Brahma the creator, Vishnu the sustainer, and Rudra the destroyer or the reabsorber. So you see that it is an amalgamation of all previous theological ideas, Hindu theological ideas. It's coming together here. So that Brahma, Vishnu and Rudra were not neglected. They are also God. But Brahma is God where the Rajas, the dynamic strand of the personality works more. And so he creates. And Vishnu, nothing said there, only said Shuddha Sattva, pure Sattva, and Rudra, the destroyer, who is really where the strand of Tamas comes in predominance. And through all this, so these are the 5 ways of God showing us himself. Nirakara God, who is Vishnu, Sakara is Purusha, Adideva, the 2nd stage, and the 3rd stage at the cosmic stage, the 3 cosmic gods.
Sorry, is this within the works of Madhusudana? This was his perspective?
It is actually Bhopadeva and Madhusudana's commentary together. Here, Bhopadeva is really the one that Madhusudana follows. And it is a bit different from the Pancharatra system, because they don't say this thing. So it is later, 13th century idea, where the threefold cosmic gods are there, everybody knows them, and they have to be incorporated in the theology. You cannot push them away. nobody will would have loved Bhagavad Purana for that. You see, that how you change your theological outlook in order to, you accommodate but slightly change the old ideas. You see, that is the difference when the this is, one can say, paradigm change, maybe. I am not so familiar with it because it's actually a scientific word. But it is the change, which is accretion, innovation, and losing some. And that is that happened in this period. So Madhusudana was in trouble because he was a pure Advaita Vedantin of the Shankara provenance, and he was a monk converted, ordained by the Dashanami, Shankara Dashanami Sampradaya, which have different Bharati, etc., the titles, and in his case Saraswati. And he was completely in that line of monks, monk followers of Shankara, who started from Padmapada, etc., etc., Bhaktagatman, coming all the way down to Chitsukacharya. They were all monks. They believed in God. But they believed in completely uncompromised transcendence of reality. They believed God, but in a lower sense. The real transcendent object is something, Brahman, and Brahman is bliss. But whatever other things we see, very much the idea, the philosophy is here, going into the epistemological way, which is very important. The epistemological way is what we experience, what we cognize. The whole empirical experience group is said that it contains only three elements. The person who is cognizing, the cognizer, the object that is being cognized, and the process of cognition. All three are there because they couldn't have any contact between each other excepting the conscious reality, which is also illumination. And so when the conscious reality is here, then it becomes illuminated. And when the conscious entity is in me, illuminating my mind, I know it is. And these the three, drik, the cognizer, drishya, the original, the content of the cognition, and the process. And these three things are absolutely same. And this is problematic with the devotionals, that what happens about the devotion, because Bhagavata Purana says that devotion, bhakti, is not only a process or not only a system to make one pure enough to go and think or do the yoga, but bhakti is the goal as well, because it's as nobody can get to the goal without making oneself completely a renouncer and a pure person without any attachment. They cannot really have the concept of that concept of bhakti in which the personality of the devotee is drowned in the God. That much is clear. But in that way, it was very difficult for the Gopi Gitas because they didn't do that thing. They didn't go for yoga. The Gopis didn't at all think of detachment. Forget about it. They are very attached. And the Gopis, nevertheless, was considered to be so much excited of that religious experience, which completely covers them, immerses them. They don't think of anything else. So that part is what Bopadeva elaborates, which is his and also Madhusudana. They were saying that the importance of Bhagavata Purana is that it has three ways of presenting the divine. In a way, it is the Shastric, the Upanishadic way, which is like a master is telling the subjects or pupils what they should know and do, and they should just obey him. The second way was the ways of Agamas and others and philosophical treatises, where it's like a friend. All these injunctions, Vedic injunctions, as a friend explains properly. So that's the side is also in Bhagavata Purana. It explains like a friend what really that means. But the third one is much more exacting and much more interesting. Third poem is, it is a kavya. A kavya is like a beloved wife who, when her husband has something to know, he helps the husband to understand it by a sweet method, by making it very attractive. A kavya is like that. It's a sweet method. And Bhagavata Purana is also attractive because it has adopted the kavya method, the sweet method. The importance of that is that it is not an order. It's not just, it's either listen to me, it's for your good. I am making it so attractive that you do it. Okay, now I leave for the questions.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you very, very much. Very interesting. Helps put some picture behind the context of what Madhusudana Saraswati is trying to do and what's different and distinctive as well about the way in which he's doing them. First of all, any questions?
I have a slightly technical one. Do you have here the famous passage from the Taittiriya Upanishad, Rasovaisa?
Yes, that was, yes.
I'm just wondering, does Madhusudana quote this?
Yes, that's why I put it there.
Okay.
What's his
It is in Taittiriya Upanishad, in the Brahmabali. There is a whole system of how do you know Brahman? And there is what the various things, Amrita here, it is Amrita, it is this and that. But the one thing is that raso vai sah. It is, but use the word of sah, masculine. But talking about Brahman, which is not masculine, raso vai sah, rasa hiyavayam labdhva, Anandi Bhavati, the person who grasps Labdhva, this rasa entity, that is the supreme reality, becomes blissful. Anandi Bhavati. That is the way to it presented. Now all the literary people, when they were following the Abhinavagupta's right and so, take this rasa, even Bharata. Rasa means two things. One is essence, sap, but also literary rasa, the aesthetic enjoyment. And as connected with anandibhavati, the bliss, it is this enjoyment part is there, focused. And Bhagavata Purana mentions it, Bhopadeva mentions it, Madhusudana Saraswati mentions it, many others, including Shankara, mentions it, other Advaita Vedantins, and of course, all the from Madhva onwards, they mention it. That is, God is very good because He is so enjoyable. So, from the yogic Shantarasa, instasy, and so it becomes ecstasy. And all this Bhagavata Purana and all the other people, also Chaitanya's group and so, which didn't really influence Madhusudana because they were almost contemporary, and Vallabhacharya himself, Madhusudana has more affinity to Baladeva for Vallabhacharya than others, took hold of that Upanishadic turn. God is not only Nitya, Shuddha, Buddha, Mukta, Swabhava, but also Rasa.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I ask is I just went through all the early Gaudiya texts looking for this phrase. It's kind of in very slow preparation for the talk I'm giving in this series in 2 weeks from now. It's a phrase that in later authors in the Chaitanya tradition is quoted repeatedly and sort of given repeatedly. But interestingly enough, in neither Rupa Goswami never quotes it. He just never refers to it, even though rasa is such a central concept for him. And Jiva Goswami quotes it a number of times, but all but once his interest in the phrase is not on rasa, but is on sa, that it's masculine. Mm. And he doesn't care about the rasa, he just sort of ignores it. And then only once does he attach importance to the fact that it talks about rasa, and that is in his commentary on the third verse of the Bhagavata,
yes.
Which to me seems more like Sridhar Swami is doing this. Sridhar Swami brings in this passage.
Yes.
And then because Jiva has such respect for Sridhar, he kind of has to bring this in as well, but otherwise they don't engage with this at all, which is very interesting to me, because this is what I'll be talking about later.
The thing is that don't lose sight of the two types of bhakti. Bhakti yoga, also mentioned by Sridhar Swami and by Bhopadeva, that this is a yoga with three bhumikas, three steps, on which the bhakta, the devotee, slowly, slowly removes all the impurities of mind through renunciation through it. It's a yoga. At the top level, the external world makes no sense to him or her, and then is the gnosis, don't forget, it's gnosis of the reality reveals to him, and it is bliss. And second thing you must have a look is that what Abhinavagupta did, in a way, the sort of very much in the literary view, and so that you have all this stimuli which stimulates the passion or emotion in mind, which then comes to a very height to the spectator, audience, or reader, and that person enjoys the beauty of it. Now, because it is actually a mental mode, because it is it happens in the mind of the person who is listening, who is viewing, or who is actually reading. It is the mental mode becomes reflected with this pure joy, because it is pure, because it doesn't really concern him or her. If I see somebody is doing on the stage, it's not me. I identify, but I identify in a limited way. And that way, that's why it is a pure revelation of the ineffable Brahman, because the ego is not there. Separation, automatic separation of ego. Because I am not concerned, really. I'm just making myself, imposing on the characters and all that, but I am not there. I may be quite different. And since at that point I suppress my I, the ego, that's the point when I am uniting with Brahman. It's the ego which makes me separate from him. And that is Abhinavagupta's idea. It's not the gopi songs. Gopi songs have to do nothing. They are so that they take a look at or hear a sound of Krishna's body or Krishna's music. They are immersed in Krishna without stimuli, without anything. And that is the difference from Abhinavagupta. We didn't have to do anything, because we are not. We are, if I am gopi, by virtue of being gopi, I am like that. And what Madhusudana and Gopadeva both said, that Krishna and gopi and Krishna's lila are not different. They're just the same thing. So, it is a sort of play of things which are at the same time happening. And this is, if you say, if you like, it's a sort of Advaita, but it is a mystical Advaita in which gopis are enjoying themselves, maybe, but enjoying all right, and participating with the beloved on the equal terrain. The beloved is not anything higher. They can do, there is a story later in the Gopa, in the Braja, that somebody came from Mathura that Krishna is a bit ill, and all he needs is a devotee's dust of the feet. He couldn't get it. No devotee will give you the dust of the feet, and his or her feet. He came to Braja, and all gopis came out with their feet out. Take as much as you can, because they are same. They are on the similar ground. There is no difference of status. Yes?
Can I follow up on that?
Yes.
I mean, it's sort of, from my own reading of Madhusudan Saraswati, I kind of see him as a person that has two very sort of sides to him. On the one hand, there's the Madhusudan Saraswati of the Advaita Siddhi and sort of a very hardcore Vedantic, Advaita Vedantic
Madhusudan. He
and on the other hand, you have the Madhusudan Saraswati of the Bhakti Rasayana, even of the Bhagavad Gita Bhasha that he writes. And I mean, I was curious about this particular passage from the Upanishad, because it sort of seems to bridge these two. It's Upanishadic, so it's pure Vedantic, and yet it's sort of very much in line, or at least in his reading of it, and of the of the Bhakti Rasayana and the other kind of the more emotional sort of type of bhakti that he's in.
Now you will see I have quoted some of his verses there.
Yeah.
And that is very important why I quote them. When he was writing Advaita Siddhi, at the beginning of that, you start with praying to your God. The God is, he names Vishnu. I'll say the first one. I adore dear Vishnu, who is nothing, who is beyond all, beyond everything, and so it's the first one. And there he finally says, Vishnu is actually the soteriological aim, the goal, the mukti, the emancipation, the salvation. He is salvation. This is a very Advaita Vedantic idea, that salvation and Brahman are not different. The next one is that you will see, let's say, going one step later, it is talking about Krishna. And the Krishna was, can I have one of those, please? The Krishna was a little bit different and said, I bow down to the lotus-eyed Krishna, is the Sankshepa Sharidaka Mangalacharanam, who has moon-like handsome face, who being moved by the austerity of Nanda, took mortal birth in Vrindavana, where he always plays on his flute. There's nothing to say about his transcendence or anything. Go further down. The definition of Brahma, of bhakti, realization, is, I don't go into the Sanskrit, but bhakti is the mode of mind which is a result of incessant practice of Bhagavad Dharmas and has melted it and which is constantly flowing towards God, Lord, never stopping. He comes that far.
This is Bhakti Rasayana?
It's Bhakti Rasayana. And then he goes further. And further is that the passionate lovers of Govinda tasting the nectar of his lotus feet suddenly realizes the plenum and its joy, its God. They thus, in a trice, overcome all false empirical experience and arrives at the gnosis of intense bliss. It's the Bhagavad Gita 9. The final one is the final 18th, after 18th, the commentary on the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And there you can see his dilemma. I do not know any higher reality than Krishna, who carries a flute in his hand, who is as dark as the rain cloud, who wears yellow clothes, and whose lips are as red as the ripe bimba fruit, whose face is as beautiful as the full moon, and whose eyes are like lotus. And further he adds to it that there are very wonderful pundits who know much more about the real identity of God. But my mind has been stolen by this stealer of gopi minds. You see, the two things is he never resolved it.
Can I? He sounds very conflicted. Can I ask an ignoramus's question here? This part sounds obviously very much like a lot of the Bheda Advaita
very much
later ones, and in some ways what he's saying, this kind of Advaitic interpretations sound quite similar too. So just for in my ignorance,
oh,
what in his Advaita is more Advaitic than that of, say, Vallabhar and the Goswamis?
Because his definition of bhakti. I told you that in the definition he is saying the Advaitic question, Advaitic idea is to understand, that's the Advaitic philosophy, is to understand the truth, the reality, by cognition. It's epistemology. And the cognition is completely, I said, the three things, the drik, the drishya, or the pramata and the pramaya. Now, this pramaya is very important. You will see many Vedantic texts were saying so many pramayas, pramaya darshana, dik, drishya, veda, etc., etc. They are talking about. That is the resolving place. That Vedanta must have this controversy or the clash between drik and drishya. Which one? The Advaita Vedantins say the drishya is not existent. It's false. And that's the Advaita Shankara Vedantins. And Madhusudan, after writing Advaita Siddhi, cannot say no. Because he wrote huge three chapters to prove that drishya is false. It is hallucination. Don't believe in it. If you say that why then they are there, but people react. So then they created the two sets of strata, like the Buddhists, of reality. One is the vavaharika, for the everyday work. You accept a certain reality which lasted a certain period, say our life, say the life of the creation, whatever it is. But there is a higher state, paramarthika, where from that point it doesn't exist. It's a Buddhist idea, or the idea of Vasishtha Ramayana, Yoga Vasishtha. There is also that closer. And on the other hand, what there is that other things which stays very long, the short time of the experience. Sometimes we all are subjected to it, that in the we all see sometimes a ghost, which as the ghost stay, as long as I'm seeing the ghost, I'm frightened. And I run away. I can do anything. I can also or try to attack the ghost or whatever it is, but I'm acting. And when I see it is ghost, then I think I am a fool. I shouldn't have done that. But until then, I have reacted. So it is that way. That wouldn't do with bhakti. And when he is having this bhakti thing, then, and it is the world view of it is, I feel my feelings. I cannot say I am not, because the bhakti is excitement, it's a passion. And that passion has been glorified by Bhagavata Purana and Bhopadeva's clarification of the rasas and their various forms. So comes the problem that I am Advaita Vedantins, he says that. Again, in his one of the conclusion, that I am like that, but I beg the pardon of all the pandits because my mind has been taken away. So I am mindless. My mind has been taken away by that Krishna. You see, he is Krishna-based. So that was the problem there, his problem. And his problem was not solved. Even in Bhakti Rasayana, he comes back with the theory, Advaita Vedanta's theory, that all this knowledge, even the experience of bhakti, is a reflection of reality, not reality. So you see, it is never solved. It's always clashing him.
Any further questions?
Please. Yes?
I just got interested in the Sufi kind of approach to God.
Yes.
As long as you believe in the good, as long as you respect the good, and the good will protect you.
Yeah.
And does it have any implication on the Markata Kishora theory in Bhagavad Gita?
Yes, I mean, the thing is that's slightly difficult. The difficult thing is that there are two types of dependence on God. In one dependence of God, you so believe in it, in His efficacy and His total responsibility to save you, that you behave like a kitten. The kitten mother bites the or the tiger, any of the cat, right? They bite your the baby's vital point here. A bit more a sharper bite, the baby will go, but takes it to a safe place. So there is complete dependence. Markata is not that. If you've never seen a Markata child, a baby Markata,
a monkey
is hanging on you for his life. If you put it like a squirrel or so, he hangs onto it, onto your clothes and so, lest he fails or falls down. And so the mother of a monkey jumps and goes, and she doesn't move to protect him, protect the child. So it is there, not the complete surrender. It's a little bit of your ego you keep in the form of fear. You have no fear if God is protecting you. Where comes the fear? This is the two things, the baby of a Markata and the baby of a cat. A monkey baby and a cat baby. The cat baby totally depends on mom.
So the Bhagavata Puran does not say that it's completely similar to Markata or Markata.
No, this is actually later Pancharatra, Sri Vaishnava, Tengalai thing. This theory is the Tengalai after 14th century, when there was a bifurcation of the northern and the southern thing. That is the prapatti, total prapatti. That is the symptom of a prapatti, that you do nothing. God will do everything. That's the prapatti dharma.
Interesting issue, the Sufi. I mean, because you said that, and I thought, which are the Sufis? Are they, you know, in a way, I suppose they're completely prapatti, but at the
same time, they
you
are
have
not.
To cleanse yourself if you, to reflect God, as it were.
Not really. Sufi, not quite that. You have to be a bit worthy of God.
Yeah, God. I'm quite ignorant of the Sufis.
God is in your mind. Your mind is a mirror house.
But you have to purify the mirror, of course.
Yes, that is everywhere. But your mom, but also you must love him dearly. Mm. Otherwise, he is very wily. He disappears, and this is very much reflected in the bowels, countryside of Bengal and Bihar. And those bowels say there is a thing that it's a bird, wild bird, but it comes in and out of the cage, because body is often compared to a cage, even in Sanskrit, in a panjara. But it flies away. Mm. How am I going to keep him? I see him in the mirror and I love him. Mm. How can I make him stay? You see, all the if you read the Sufistic literature, you see this very much, the craving, and often there is this allegorical thing about the princess who is to be married, but the prince who hears or sees something of the princess and goes out to in search of the princess. That's the Sufi idea.
Yeah, it's interesting. It makes me think of Jiva. It's almost as if there is in this period a wide-ranging desire to square bhakti with yoga, even in the Sufis, to make sort of sense of all this as an epistemological... Yes. A quite detailed, philosophically justified epistemological form of access to God, and with whether it's bhakti or Sufi love or whatever. It's,
But what also is important that this was a period of exchange. There were not any isolation. They were talking about it themselves. The nursing of Rajasthan or others, they were taking. Later, slightly later, the movement of Maharashtra, and that is a very Sufi-oriented thing, in which God, the Sufi is very interesting because the Sufis also have a God who has no form, but he can be reflected in the glass house in the mind, Chintamani in the house. And that is a sort of aim to go into that position where you can communicate face to face.
Any other questions?
So you can imagine that I am moving, that there is a Sufi influence in the development of 16th century or 15th century or even 14th century religious ideas of bhakti. I think. Nobody says so, but I put my neck out.
Well, clearly, I think absolutely. That's great. Well, I'm going to go now and get out lots of Madhusudas and pass this all in relation to the other major Advaita schools of the time and sort of clarify where those innovations and differences are. Thank you very, very, very much for bringing Madhusudana Saraswati back to us.
Okay.
It's another meeting point of many influences in this period. Thank you.
She's written one of the few
on Madhusudana Saraswati, which is here, no? Which is here on our bookshelf at this very moment. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.